The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning. We've just celebrated our annual festival of Baisaja Guru Tathagata, the Buddha of Healing, and I'd like to talk a bit about the Buddha of Healing today. At this time of the COVID-19 pandemic, we're especially transferring the merit of our practice for the benefit of all those suffering as a result of it, and invoking the aid of Baisaja Guru Tathagata in healing today. Whether it's suffering with regard to their physical health, mental, emotional states, economic hardship, and as well as blessing in particular all those who are dying, that they may enter into eternal peace and be carried by great compassion, love, and wisdom as they go on in their spiritual journey. And for that matter, all who are suffering illness and distress this day. We can open our hearts and minds to the healing power of the Buddha through our practice. And in fact, this healing power, to my mind, is manifesting right now through all the work of all those who care for the sick and dying, and who practice the bodhisattva virtues of charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, as best they can, no matter what religion or faith they follow. And of course, this doesn't just apply to medical providers and those doing research on vaccines and so on. All those who are doing their best to practice charity, really practice sympathy, are becoming, in their own way, vessels of this healing power. And I think that's important to acknowledge. We're hearing so many stories of people doing good work amidst all the challenges and difficulties that our world is facing now. And, of course, we've just had a very tragic disaster in Lebanon and terrible situation and, of course, tremendous response also, aid coming in to help beings there. So we have them all in mind today as we celebrate our Healing Buddha Festival. I'd like to talk a little bit about the iconography in the images of our Healing Buddha scrolls. You will have an image of that at the beginning of this video and at the end as well. The Pure Land of the Buddha of Healing is said to be made up of lapis lazuli. In some descriptions of the early scriptures, there's a mountain of bodhisattvas attending the assembly where the Buddha Shakyamuni is addressing the healing Buddha, and that mountain appears as a mountain of lapis lazuli, all the bodhisattvas being the golden lights within the mountain. Lots of different interpretations of these things. But the lapis lazuli stone, as you may know, has little flecks of golden pyrite in it, and so thus has a certain radiance to it within the darkness of the deep blue, which is very significant and important to Buddhists. As a teaching, it shows us that we have the ability to see what needs to be done in our training, even in the midst of darkness. And the healing Buddha is particularly associated with assisting beings in dealing with their karma, the karma of past mistakes and training, addressing those and changing their negative patterns, which promotes healing. In many depictions of the healing Buddha, he or she is shown with a blue body, representing the lapis lazuli, especially in the Nepalese and Tibetan traditions. We have one here on my right. To me, the blue body of the healing Buddha has always been very hopeful and represents the cooling of the passions, which make all healing possible. And by passions, we mean the heat or the fever, if you like, generated by our clinging to the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, which the Buddha defined as the ignorance at the root of all suffering, or dis-ease of heart and mind. In many images, the Buddha of Healing holds a begging bowl in his left hand, again, from my experience, representing the complete and positive acceptance of all that comes to us in our daily lives. It specifically refers to meditation practice, which is the Healing Buddha's balm, healing balm. The hand posture that we use, and I'll show those watching on the internet, the hand posture that we use in meditation with the right or left hand on top of the other actually resembles an alms bowl of all acceptance and embracing everything that arises without clinging. In other words, allowing all aspects of our experience to arise, abide, and pass, to flow through all thoughts, emotions, feelings, sensations, perceptions, physical being, comfort, discomfort, our experience, if you like, of the five skandhas, just allowing them to flow through, not attaching to any of it, as best we can. So we are creating a sort of alms bowl with our hands. The thumbs touching help us with attentiveness, one-pointedness of mind, with stillness in the midst of all that arises and passes. So often in these depictions of the Healing Buddha, his right hand is in the mudra of offering, or sometimes holding a flowering herb, or sometimes the herb is seen growing out of the alms bowl of the Healing Buddha. And this represents the medicine of the Dharma arising out of our meditation practice. And again, is the Dharma being the balm that this Buddha administers as the foundation for all true healing. And the medicine Buddha is also, in particular, certainly in the Far East and Central Asia, has been very much associated with helping people have a good death as well as healing. So in Buddhism, training oneself to have a good death is just as important as training oneself to heal whilst alive. The Buddha of Healing the devotion to the Buddha of Healing comes from early scriptures, Mahayana scriptures written around the 2nd and 3rd centuries and later. There are stories of a king of healing. Supreme Healer was another one. There were apparently two brothers who made vows to help heal beings from suffering. In some of our depictions here, we have seven Buddhas in a halo around the central healing Buddha figure. And so in some of the expanded versions of the early Vaisajaguru scriptures, there are seven healing Buddha brothers, the king of healing, the central one being the leader of them. And in some depictions, they're all combined into one. And this being, if you like, the healing Buddha, really represents the body of the Dharma, the body of the law. In some depictions, there are 12 yaksha generals around the base of the Buddha's throne. And the yakshas in ancient Indian mythology were fierce beings, that demonic beings that created diseases in people. And it's said that they were converted to the three jewels. They took refuge in the three treasures and thus became the guardians of the healing Buddha. And it's said to be very important that the healing Buddha be cherished and treated as precious. And in fact, all that we give rise to in ourselves that promotes healing is considered very precious, whether it be spiritual, physical, mental healing. So he has these 12 yaksha generals, these fierce-looking guys, at the base of his throne, protecting him. This also represents, of course, all these aspects of the iconography relate to aspects of our training. So it does show the conversion of past negative karma, if you like, anger to love and compassion, fear to equanimity and so on and so forth. Sometimes it's said that the 12 Yaksha generals also refer to each of the 12 vows of this healing Buddha, which I'll go into shortly. In some depictions of the healing Buddha, also there are two bodhisattva guardians on his left and right. There's the all-pervading solar radiance bodhisattva, the sun bodhisattva, and the all-pervading lunar radiance bodhisattva, holding an image of the moon in some depictions. I think on our central image here, one of them holds the Buddha's begging bowl, the other holds the scriptures. And the Buddha himself, in this central image behind me, is actually holding a pagoda, representing, of course, the storehouse of the scriptures, the medicine of the Dharma. I think it may also refer to the fact that the Buddha the healing Buddha in a previous life built a pagoda in honor of a Buddha that he was training with. So there are many references from the scriptures in all this iconography. But again, always coming back to the healing power of the Dharma. I thought it would be interesting to look at the 12 vows of the healing Buddha by Sajjaguru, because they're just as relevant today, I say, except for one of them, which I'll talk about, especially with what's going on in our world today, and to know that there is that which is looking out for us in this world. These are vows that it's said that the a young man who was training made these vows, a very devoted young man in training made these vows, and eventually in other reincarnations became the healing Buddha. So these vows have gone through a number of past lives. And again, these vows are especially concerned with helping beings accept their karmic inheritance and transform the path of their karma toward enlightenment. So the first one is by Sajjaguru's 12 vows, in summary. First one is, may a radiant light blaze forth from my body after enlightenment, brightening countless realms, and may all beings have perfect physical form, identical to my own. And again, this light is intended to help us to see what needs to be done in our training. The second one, may my body be like pure and radiant lapis lazuli, with a radiance more brilliant than the sun and moon, illuminating all who travel in darkness, enabling them to tread upon their paths. Number three, by my limitless insight and means, may I enable all beings to obtain the necessities of life. And any one of these, any of us can take up any one of these, by the way, and people do, you know. This is how good things happen in the world, because there are people out there making these vows, whether they realize it or not, in their daily training. Number four, may all beings be shown the path of enlightenment, and may adherence to the Sravaka or Pacheka Buddha paths become established in Mahayana practices. In other words, may beings open their hearts to being of benefit to others and let go of training just for their own selfish purposes. And this is not a comment on any other religious practices, of course. Number five, may all beings be aided to follow the precepts of moral conduct. After hearing my name, those who have broken the precepts will be aided to regain their purity and prevented from sinking to a woesome path of existence. Number six, may all who are deformed or handicapped in any way have their deformities removed upon hearing my name. Seven, may all who are ill be cured upon hearing my name. Well, this one's, you're not going to like this one. I don't. Number eight, may women who beset by woes seek to become men, be reborn as men in their next life. Now, I'm going to read you. Of course, that's very insulting to women, and it's been the cause of much controversy and really quite stupid speculation and confusion in Buddhism over the years, an unnecessary confusion. And the author of this book I'm quoting from, The Healing Buddha by Raoul Birnbaum has some comments on this, which I thought were interesting. There's a later version of these vows that is depicted in a Chinese scroll showing by Sajaguru, and these vows are all depicted around him with the text under them. And it's interesting that this one was changed in that version. It was a few centuries later, which shows you that Buddhist scriptures are always evolving and should be evolving and applicable to the times that we're in. So that's the foolishness of holding on to these old things that don't work. But here he says, regarding that, he's talking about the comparison with this later scroll and these early written vows in the early scriptures. He says, the most significant variation between the two is the omission of the usual eighth vow, to aid all women to become men in their next incarnation. Here the scroll has the following. Instead of that vow, it says, for the sake of all simple and limited sentient beings, I shall proclaim the marvelous law. This is the Healing Buddha speaking. They shall be caused to gain passage to the other shore, nirvana, to escape from the cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death. They shall enter the gate of wisdom. I shall cause all things to be clear to them, so that they shall no longer have doubts of their own Buddha nature. So there you go. Doesn't mention women at all. And that was just a number of centuries later, changed in Chinese culture. And the author goes on to say, it is apparent from remarks in the standard versions of the Baisajaguru Sutra that the text originally was composed in a region where women had very low status, where life as a woman was accompanied by many sorrows. And it's said that these were authored somewhere in the sort of northeast Indian Kashmir region, most likely, and became very popular in China. He goes on to say, a vow to assist women to gain incarnation as men would be ludicrous and repellent if this were not the case. It is likely that the sutra may have been modified by a traveling monk eager to spread Buddhist teachings in China, who, finding himself in a region where women held higher status, quickly realized that the eighth vow of Baisajaguru would have a dampening effect on the eagerness of a substantial portion of the population to listen and learn, as would be very much the case today. But it's amazing how much people hang on to that still. And it's given Buddhism kind of a bad rap in some areas. In the illustration of this vow, in the scroll, the Chinese scroll, the later one, a monk is lecturing to a group of men and women who are apparently studying as equals. So I thought that was interesting. And of course, you know, we could think of this vow, the intention of this vow, really to be to assist all those who are disadvantaged. And we certainly have our share of that in our society now, whether it be women, Black Americans, Native Americans, people throughout the world who are suffering as a result of prejudice, economic hardship, whatever it might be. So perhaps we could convert that vow to be an expression of wishing them to succeed and to have equality with all beings. Number 9 vow, may all who are caught in Mara's net, entangled in negative views, be caused to gain correct views and thus practice the Bodhisattva way. The Buddha referred to opinions and views as the thicket. He refers to the thicket of views, entanglement in the thicket of views. And if you've ever been entangled in a thicket of views, which can easily happen if you read too much of the news, actually, and opinion, you know, columns, it can make you feel quite ill, isn't it? You know, I've had that experience. Maybe we all have. So it's interesting how many of these issues can result in physical, mental illness as well, if they're not caught early on. Number 10, may all who are to be punished by the king, at that time would have been a king, be freed of their troubles. Number 11, may those who are desperately famished be given food. May they ultimately taste the sublime teachings. And number 12, May all who are destitute of clothes obtain attractive garments and various adornments upon concentrating on my name. So the Healing Buddha was very much associated with elevating the status of beings, helping them all the essentials of daily life, very practical, as well as the realization that unless beings have these essentials, it's very hard for them to see the need to train themselves and go on more deeply. Doesn't mean they have to be wealthy, but just they have to have the very basic needs and be treated with respect. Thus, he says, two of his vows deal specifically with physical healings and medicine, while others deal with healing in the sense of alleviating suffering and making beings whole physically and spiritually. So we have much need of the Healing Buddha's help and his continuing vows at this present time. And it's traditional for many Asian Buddhists to call upon the Buddha of healing. I certainly have done this myself in my own training at a time when I was very challenged and dealing with some mistakes I had made in my practice. And I decided to follow the scripture's advice and write out the scripture. It's very helpful to write out these scriptures and just call on the names of the Healing Buddha when I needed to. And I developed a very strong sense of connection with the Baisajya Guru, the Healing Buddha. So I can tell you from my own experience that it is very helpful, as long as you understand that it involves doing something about yourself as well. That's really how it all opens. But there's something about having a personal connection with the body of the Dharma in that way that is very helpful. So these are one of many practices we can take up to help ourselves when we're feeling very challenged in our training, when we're feeling ill, when we're close to the time of death, and so on. Now, Shakyamuni Buddha was often referred to in his life as the supreme physician, and many analogies were made between his offering teaching as treatment, as the great surgeon, supreme physician, and so on. It's interesting that his Four Noble Truths, Shakyamuni's teaching of the Four Noble Truths, were apparently expressed in the format of ancient Indian medicine theory. To quote an ancient Ayurvedic writing, the best physician, one to treat a king, is he or she whose knowledge is fourfold. The symptom, first, the cause, the cure, and then the non-recurrence of diseases. The 4th century, in the common area, monk and great teacher Buddha Gosa, in his Visuddhimagga, The Path of Purity, approached the Four Noble Truths as what follows. The truth of ill or dukkha, or suffering, is like a disease. And in some writings, all beings are considered ill until they actually reach full awakening. One way of looking at it. And I think actually that can be helpful sometimes because it takes a lot of the judgment out of, you know, being good or bad, because there's no good or bad in all this. We all have this disease. So the truth of ill, dukkha, or suffering is like a disease, and then the truth of the origin is like the cause of the disease. The truth of cessation of suffering is like the allaying of disease. And the truth of the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, is like the medicine or the treatment. And I find that a helpful way of looking at it. So the Dharma, as mentioned, is often referred to as the medicine that cures suffering. In the Lotus Scripture, there's also mention of the Healing Buddha, and it is emphasized in the Lotus Scripture that the law or the Dharma, which it's the law or in capital with a capital L, or the Dharma, which actually does the healing. The teacher of the law is the vessel conveying the law to those who are ill. So in one sense, the images of the Healing Buddha, of the body of the Buddha, represents the medicine of the Dharma. And this reminds me of Reverend Master Jiu used to, when she taught us years ago, and she often did, she did talks for people in health professions, psychologists, psychiatrists, many people in helping professions, including ourselves. And she would emphasize that the doctor and the patient, or the teacher and the student, the helper and the one who's being helped, are really just two people seeking together the key to life and union with the eternal, is how she expressed it. And she emphasized, and there's always been emphasis in Buddhism, on the importance of not seeing oneself as the source of help or the source of healing. You're in big trouble if you do that. So it always involves letting go of the self, getting the self out of the way, whether you're working in the world or as a monk, helping beings. The first step is to be still and let go of the self and any pride or inadequacy, for that matter, with regards to being effective. And drawing on one's knowledge, certainly, but not to attach a big me to being a helper or a doctor, a medical provider, whatever. So again, just two people seeking together the key to life and union with that which is greater than all of us. This, you could see this as a formula, of course. I think it's also very helpful, if I may add, for parents and children, you know. I think a lot of problems can be avoided in families if we take that attitude with our children as well. Really just coming into this world as two people seeking together the key to life. So she taught that this can be applied to all those in the helping professions, as I mentioned, including spiritual teachers, to counteract, as I say, the tendency of the helper placing themselves in a superior role over the patient or student, which really makes it very difficult for the one being helped to have confidence and to embark on a path of healing or learning. And that teaching has really stuck with me and got me through lots of difficult patches. Actually, in all relationships, to be honest, personally. The Buddha is said to often have used his teachings on impermanence and non-self, or the basic characteristics of human existence, as treatment for his disciples. We talk about this a lot, but a very, very helpful teaching. The first characteristic being dukkha, that all of us are subject to suffering, stress, as some people call it, dis-ease of heart. Anicca, that everything is impermanent. There's nothing in reality to cling to. And anatta, that there's no separate or enduring self, little self that stays the same, that I can call me forever and ever. And these spiritual insights, when taken into our daily training, actually become a source and, I believe, a foundation for all other healing, the medicine of the Dharma. Speaking from glimmers of my own experience, I would say the acknowledgement of the existence of suffering makes us humble and opens us to all acceptance and compassion for ourselves and others. We're all in the same boat. And seeing the impermanence of all things, including our own earthly lives, opens us to the flow of real selfless love. There's a flow there. We don't have to be hanging on to things all the time, and clinging to things of the past or fearing things of the future can be a cause of real illness, mental and physical. And also maintaining an awareness that there is not, or cultivating an awareness that there is not a permanent separate self, eventually opens us up to the realization, to my mind, of real freedom and wisdom. It's, for me, the most freeing thing. If I can just change my perspective a little when something's troubling me, or I'm irritated or upset about something, to just be still with it and allow an empty space to be there. You know, who is this that's upset? Who is this that's worried? Who is this that's angry? It's just feeling, and just to let it pass through. There's nothing there of absolute substance. And so that's extremely liberating to my mind. even when one just has little glimmers of it. And we could see that the little golden flecks in the lapis lazuli, in the Buddha's pure land, the healing Buddha's pure land, are perhaps also these little insights that we have that help us as we go through darkness and light through our lives. And these little gems of teaching that carry us along. So taking this medicine of the Buddha's teaching leads us into what the Buddha called nirvana, which by some accounts is the fourth characteristic of existence, that which is beyond all opposites, the third position, oneness with the great eternal, really just resting in our true nature, who we really are. So these are great gifts of healing that we can offer whenever we allow these insights into our own lives and manifest them in our relationships with others. Now, I should say that, of course, illness will happen. It doesn't mean that if we're ill, we're doing bad training. In some of the old texts, in the Pali Canon and so on, it's clear that the Buddha considered some ailments to be caused by past karma, past life, or this life karma. Some were so heavy that the person may never have recovered, but he would still assist them in doing the best they could to train with it, and then when they came to the point of death. In the Mahayana teachings, and Reverend Master G used to talk about this, we sometimes think of people who have a heavy load of karma like this, whether it's with regard to mental illness or physical illness, often at a young age especially, that there is a kind of bodhisattva's dream that has picked up some heavy karma in this life and is dealing with it. And so, again, it points to a very different perspective that Buddhism has with regards to these things, to really let go of the good and bad judgments with regards to all of these things and our karma. It's just what is happening. It's just what we're born with, what we're training with. There isn't an enduring self in any of this. I hope that makes some sense. A very important aspect of Buddhist teaching. There are, things that are caused by karma that we can change. And then there are abrupt awakenings, things that as a result of hearing the Buddha's teaching where something just turns around very quickly. All of the above can happen with regards to spiritual ailments, physical and mental. But the training is always the same. The medicine is basically the same. And without the foundation of the medicine of the Dharma, other healing is much more difficult. Medicines work better. Everything works better. Couple things that also that Reverend Master said to me, and I've heard her say with regards to illness. I remember her saying that fear will exacerbate an illness. And I've certainly found that to be true for myself. Fear might arise, of course, just like anything else. It's perfectly normal, especially if we're gravely ill, and I've been fortunate not to have a great deal of that, although I've had my challenges. However, if we train ourselves to sit still with it as just emotion or feeling, we learn to see through it, to see it for what it is. It's insubstantiality, an appearance of one of our impermanent skandhas, a passing cloud, a phantasm, a dream, as the Diamond Scripture says. Yeah. And I found this to be very, very important. It's really interesting to see what fear can do. Not to be afraid of fear, that doesn't help. But just to know that it doesn't, it's like worry. It doesn't actually ultimately do much good. In some cases, fear can keep us from a dangerous situation. That's useful, but we don't have to allow it to take us over. So, to watch that. And then she also said something interesting, which could easily be misunderstood, but I remember her saying, and one always has to be careful of taking one's teacher's teachings out of context, but enjoy the illness in relation to not being fearful of it. And of course, it doesn't mean that we don't take care of ourselves and seek good medical advice, take up treatment. On the contrary, it does mean that when ill, it works best to truly accept the condition of illness and relax into it, which greatly helps open the door to allowing healing to take place. So I believe what she's talking about from my own experience is just acknowledge it, accept it. This is human existence. Yeah. On the deepest level, it helps us to take refuge in that which embraces all of the skandhas of this current being of ours, trusting in its impermanence and emptiness of a separate self, and placing faith in the true boundless self beyond the small self that we think of as me and without permanent characteristics. So these are foundational teachings that are very helpful in healing on all levels. They don't stand against seeing a doctor, getting medical help. It doesn't mean that if you see there's some karmic connection with an illness or a problem that you're having, that you don't seek medical advice. Of course, that can be a big mistake. They don't stand against each other. Buddhist teachings and science don't stand against each other. But without these fundamental teachings, the real healing, the deeper healing, that which takes us beyond this life, is not possible. So I hope that gives you a little bit of helpful teaching on the Healing Buddha and some of our teachers' advice with regards to healing. And I'll end this talk with this lovely couple of verses of this lovely invocation of Reverend Master Daiswes on the Lord of Healing. Lord of Healing, Lord of Light, see the suffering of this plane. Ease its darkness, strife, and pain with thy Buddha Dharma. Blessed art thou who vow to save being stricken with all ills, who can bend their stubborn wills to thy teaching skillful. O Lord Buddha of the sick, who amongst us needs you not? Minds and hearts and spirits hot yearn for cool deliverance. By Saja, Lord of Truth, free our minds from anger's hand and delusion's deadly band by thy blade of wisdom. You who know the paths of all, help us bear our karma stings. Teach acceptance of the things birth and death are heir to. I'll leave you with those inspiring thoughts on this day, and may all in this world who need healing be free from suffering. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.